This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to talk with Kim Martinson. She represents an organization called Braver Angels, and this is a discussion I've been looking forward to because what Kim and her group are looking to do is to get us to talk with each other, not at each other. Kim, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much. I'm thrilled to be here.
The organization is Braver Angels. What is it?
Well, Braver Angels is an organization that was founded in 2016, just after the 2016 election. And it's just an organization that unites Reds, Reds and Blues, which means conservative-leaning folks and liberal-leaning folks together in an alliance to depolarize America. And we do a lot around the nation, but I think it's very interesting. It started actually, one of the founders is Bill Doherty from the University of Minnesota.
How did you get involved?
Well, I retired in 2016, and as people that are retired know, you have to kind of recreate yourself and take your skills and find something to do because I have a long life ahead of me. So I read an article in a local online newspaper called MinnPost, and it was Bill Doherty. And I knew Bill Doherty because he worked in, he did a lot of workshops for families, and I had been at several of his workshops, and I went, oh, I can call him and email him. And we met at the University of Minnesota, and I just said, you know, this is right in my wheelhouse. It's totally what I've done my whole life is sort of negotiating with people. I worked in a high school for a setting for 38 years, and I just felt like I was at home, and I found a really great way to use the skills that I have as well as really do work that really matters, I believe.
What should we infer from the name Braver Angels?
Well, it started out as Better Angels, which comes from the quote from Abraham Lincoln prior to his initial inauguration in 1861. And he talked about the braver angels of our nature are the people that need to come together to solve the major issues in our country. So he was saying we need to work together at that point. And so, but we had to change our name because turns out Better Angels is used by Ken Burns, and that's his money-making company that he has that works alongside all of the work that he does. So we said, well, we don't have to be Better Angels. We have to be Braver Angels. And it was really actually, in retrospect, at the time it was sort of a crisis. But, you know, out of a crisis comes good things. So it was changed to Braver Angels. And I think it's really timely because to have these conversations, it takes bravery to make those conversations happen.
It also takes a village, and that village has to have different opinions. So when people first hear about it, do they consider it liberal or a group of do-gooders? How do you assemble the necessary components to have meaningful discussion?
Well, I think that people, citizens of this country, are tired of the hatred and the vilification and the negative conversations that take place among their family members around the dining room table, the Thanksgiving table. And I think it is has the potential to destroy our country and our democracy. So it's not just someone like me who has those views. I think we should all be very concerned about the division that we have in our country currently.
Who belongs? I mean, you've been at a number of these events involving Braver Angels. Who do you see?
All different types of people. I have, before the pandemic, of course, you know, our lives right now are pre-pandemic and post-pandemic, but before the pandemic, I was traveling all over the place in the state of Minnesota, and other people were also, to put on workshops, to give speeches, to just pull in anybody that there are, religious communities are involved. Schools, educational facilities. I was at the University of Minnesota at Morris having a conversation with Reds and Blues there. We have a Red Blue workshop, and it was one of the best ones we've ever had. They were college kids on one side, and there were lots of farmers on the other side, ranchers, and it was a fascinating day. We have had workshops both in Rochester, really throughout the state. St. Olaf is an interesting place. You think of it as a very liberal college, but they are working really intensely to solve the depolarization that's happening within their school.
How does it work when you have one of these workshops? What happens?
Well, we have about five different workshops. We also put on debates, but we can talk about that in a minute. But the workshops, there are some really great ones to start out with. One is a skills workshop, and the purpose of a skills workshop really is to develop the communication skills. And I liken it to communication 101, where you go back to your first year of college and go, oh, yeah, I remember that. So really, it's about how do we have conversations across the political divide? What are the strategies? How do we set the tone for the conversation? How do we figure out how to have to set a tone? It's about listening. It's about speaking, and you have to get your point across. Also, it's not just about sitting there listening to somebody else, but it is about listening to learn and listening to really not listening to respond, because we've all been in those conversations where they're listening to you, you think, but they're really not listening. They're just waiting to respond. So it's really listening to learn. And so it's a skills workshop. There's depolarizing within, which is a workshop where really and I would venture to say we are all depolarized. We are all living in a bubble, or as they call it also, the silo, where you literally live in your world. You are surrounded by people that are like you, that think like you, and really don't like to venture out, don't want to venture out to meet other people or to have those conversations. Because really, for most of America today, most of us have to venture out. We have to step through a door to have a conversation with somebody from the other side. We also have, I would say it's our premier workshop, called a Red-Blue workshop.
Who's to blame for the polarization? And I ask that with the idea that maybe asking the question undermines the goal.
This is not the first time we've been divided. And we have been divided for a very long time. Lincoln was overseeing the Civil War, where we were out in fields shooting each other, and we were killing our brothers and our sisters and our fathers, and that was what the Civil War was. This is not new. It's been going on really at its most intense time that we've had since the Civil War has been really since probably the 1960s. And it has only gotten worse, where instead of the nice bell curve that we had in the 1950s and early 60s, that now it's like it's not a bell curve anymore. It's the exact opposite, where we have more people at either end of a political spectrum. So I venture to say that it is both sides. Both sides are trenched in, and they are saying, I'm not going to go your way. Joe Biden has been in Congress for years, and he used to collaborate, and Congress used to collaborate. And they are not doing that at this point. And that's why I think the American public is pretty disgusted with what goes on in Congress, is because we all know we have major issues we need to address, and people need to come to sit around the table to have conversations. But it's not just Congress. It's also all of us. We need to say, as citizens, this is our job, is to pull our country back together.
Kim Martinson is with Braver Angels. You can find out a lot about the organization at their website, braverangels.org. What's a good outcome from a Braver Angels discussion?
It's easier to be divided, because then you get to hang out with people that are like you, and it's really comfortable. And if no matter what side you're on, you get to hang with people in your tribe. But out of these conversations is really learning about, number one, about how to listen, so that you're learning. This is about learning about the other side. because it is about curiosity. So I always say that this is about leading with curiosity, not judgment. Polarization is based on judgment of others and really in a vilifying way that is not productive. So this is really about how do we see each other's humanity. I see you as a human being with values and people you love and a family. You're just like me in so many ways. So I think what comes out of this, of all things, is just that sense that we really are in this together. How we get there is different. And that's where the polarization comes in. But we can still solve problems in this country if we can come together and say, you are important, I am important. We can't live without each other. As our political system is set up to have, it's a checks and balances. And the checks and balance is red and blue. We need to balance each other out. But we can't be on either end of the teeter-totter and be productive. We really have to come and have some collaboration and consensus about what's most important in our country.
And when we talk about red and blue, we need to remember there's a fair amount of purple out there as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The website, braverangels.org, has a lot of charts and graphs and things like that, and it indicates the sort of spectrum we have and the way we relate to each other, from outright hatred and disrespect to respect. And what you're getting at here in terms of the model you're trying to follow, you talked about, you know, the initial college course, which teaches us the ethics of speech and the proper ways to communicate with each other with respect, is listening. And it's not talking at each other. It is taking the time to actually understand what the other person feels and wants to express.
Exactly. So much of it is about listening to understand the other side. And the website actually is really great because it shows in very visual, sort of, I would say, infographics to kind of go, oh, yeah, we have really changed. And this is becoming such an issue for us that, you know, we have, it's like we want to fight over everything. Everything that is really important, we seem to have decided that it's a political issue. I have a great quote that General James Mattis, who was in the Trump administration earlier, when asked, and he was in charge of national security, he said, what is the worst, largest, most concerning issue that you see in terms of national security for America? And he said, oh, it is absolutely, we have no affinity for each other. We have no affection for each other. And then if we cannot come and coalesce around an issue, a crisis situation, what will we do? So we are living that right now. We are in the middle of a pandemic where we have 10 million people that have been impacted by this and over 200,000 people that are dead. And some people decided masks are most important and others decided it was not important and it became political. And what a perfect example of what not to do. Because we are unable to solve this issue right now, and it's killing us, literally and figuratively.
The website has a number of essays on it that are written by people with different political orientations, and one that caught my eye and really was interesting was headlined, Kyle Rittenhouse is Not Who You Think He Is. Kyle Rittenhouse is the young man, the teenager, who is now facing trial for killing two people in a disturbance in Kenosha, Wisconsin, earlier this year. And as I read that article, I kept thinking, boy, the devil is in the details, isn't it?
Yeah, I will tell you, part of this whole thing is we can talk about fake news till the cows come home, but really this is to knowing the truth takes time. And we can't assume that the media that we read and we experience every day is telling us the truth. It is our job as citizens to find out the truth and find out the facts so that we can form opinions, not based on our political side, but based on what we find and what is the truth that's out there. So yes, there are all sorts of perfect examples of the impact of polarization on how we view the world, because I think that there are some people that we are divided in everything. Remember back in the good old days when it was just Walter Cronkite and we all listened to Walter Cronkite?
And that's the way it is.
And that's the way it is. And that is not the way it is now. You're exactly right.
The Kyle Rittenhouse essay was written by a person who described himself as a progressive, but I can tell you, I discovered all kinds of things about Kyle Rittenhouse as possible victim, frankly. And it reminded us of the stark difference between social media judgment, which is quick and brutal, and legal justice, which requires time and consideration and following the facts.
Yep, exactly. But the only way that citizens can find out the truth is by really spending time. And unfortunately, we don't all have time to do it, but we have to find ways to come at the truth, and not your own little truth that's in your bubble, but what is the reality that's happening out there? Right now we have two sides that are fighting over the election, and you know, but what is the truth and where do we find it? And it can't be your truth. It has to be the truth, the facts that are going on. And that would help us a lot if we all decided that we were going to step outside our silo, outside our bubble, and really see what we can find about what's really going on.
Is this movement growing?
Oh, my gosh. In the last 4 months, the membership of Braver Angels has doubled. I think people are seeing it as a way to reduce their own personal stress, as well as to have those conversations to prepare for Thanksgiving, which we're probably not going to have. I mean, I know in my house we've said, okay, we'll see you in the summer. But I think that, you know, there are families that are being torn apart, marriages that are being torn apart. It's really interesting. This really came from Bill Doherty at the University of Minnesota, who is a marriage therapist. So he's helping couples who are warring every day. And he provides a therapy for these people, but it's the same conversation. So many of these conversations I have learned, because I've dealt with teenagers and I raised a couple of my own, is that, you know, you have these skills. They can be used everywhere. They're not the skills just for a conversation on in our polarized world, but really they're conversations, a way to have a conversation with our teenagers when you're butting heads with them or with your spouse or with a sister who is on the other side of the political divide. I mean, these are skills that we just need to have to function in our society. So it's listening to understand, it's speaking your truth, it's paraphrasing, it's you know, if you start out a conversation by saying, I'm finding myself curious these days about your views on immigration. Now, that opens up the door, right? That opens up the door to that conversation. And I think that we could all use those skills across all aspects of our life. And it would just be really helpful, reduce the anxiety and the stress and the hate, which is really driving so much of the polarization that's happening right now.
Kim Martinson is with Braver Angels. Kim, how is this grassroots movement funded or supported?
There are about four people that are paid, staff members, and the rest of it is done with volunteers. So if we do a workshop in Minnesota, we have, like, I think we have four workshops in the next 2 weeks. Those of us who are organizers go out to a website that is all kept track of by volunteers, and I will have to look for people to run the Zoom, because we do everything on Zoom. I have to find someone who could manage the participants. I need to find two people who can moderate the workshop. I need somebody else who can keep track of time and just run other aspects of the workshop that can, you know, troubleshoot, because it's all about technology. So But when you're there in a workshop, there are people from around the nation. I mean, there are people from, I just was on a Zoom yesterday with a woman from Montana, and we're working together with a woman who lives in Missoula, Montana, for a workshop that's going to be really held here in Minnesota. So there will be people from South Carolina, from Florida, from New Jersey, from New York, from all over the United States. So it's modified and morphed its way into a different way of how we're doing workshops. So, but it is across the nation. People are very, very concerned about our future as a democracy, and I think that we should all be concerned. And this is just one way to make those connections with people.
Are the political parties interested in this, in Braver Angels?
Well, very interestingly, a year ago in February, Bill Doherty and another person did a skills workshop for members of the Minnesota State Legislature. And then this past October, a year ago, Bill and I did a workshop for the congressional staff in Minnesota for Pete Stauber, who is a Republican in northeastern Minnesota, and for Dean Phillips, who is a Democrat down kind of in the cities. So we met kind of halfway in Forest Lake, Minnesota, and the conversation with it's all the people that work for those two representatives. There were eight people on both sides. We spent the whole day together. So yes, we're working on that, and I think that there are many different opportunities that are happening around the nation where people are coming together on a political perspective, that our politicians that are saying this is not working at all. We have to come up with another way to form relationships and get stuff done for the citizens.
And it sounds like there would be applications beyond politics. Policies is what I'm getting at here. Environmental differences, yeah. Social justice, law enforcement, immigration, you mentioned earlier. There are lots of things that need some deep discussion.
Definitely. And we need to have discussions without vilifying each other. And, you can't vanquish the other side. Because there's a government that has to run, right? We have a country that has to run, and we can't vanquish the other side. They're still going to be there, and we need good, strong political parties in order to do what's best for our country and for our states, Minnesota, North Dakota, whoever it is. We need people that are working together to solve these issues. I think I always think about all the things we want. We all want decent roads and schools. We want good daycare for our kids. We want our college systems to be well done. We want really good agriculture because we feed the world. We want all of that. So we have to, and I think that that's common ground. So many of our conversations are about how do we find, what's the common ground that we have? I mean, I think that if you think about Election Day, the common ground we found on Election Day is that everybody wants to vote. Everybody feels invested and wants to make a difference, and they want to do that. They showed up, right? So that's, I mean, we found common ground on November 3rd in ways that we did not expect at all.
So the goal here is to remember that we are the United States of America. Kim Martinson is with Braver Angels. Find out more about the organization at braverangels.org. Kim, thanks for spending time with us today.
Absolutely.
Coming up on Main Street, a discussion about innovative entrepreneurs of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. President-elect Joe Biden has tapped a well-known infectious disease expert from Minnesota to serve on his coronavirus advisory board. Dr. Michael Osterholm is the director for the Center in Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. He says while the board has begun its work, the fight against COVID-19 will not wait until Inauguration Day.
You know, we all recognize that he will not assume office until January. And between now and then are going to be the darkest days of the pandemic. I have said that for some weeks that, you know, the case numbers we saw late summer would not prevail over time.
Osterholm says one way to stave off the worst of COVID's impacts is to wear a mask and not to, as he put it, swap air with anyone else except your immediate family. It's number five. Minnesota lawmakers will meet in special session on Thursday. They will decide if Governor Tim Walz will retain his emergency powers to manage the COVID-19 pandemic. DFL House Speaker Melissa Hortman says it should be a quick session.
A real Groundhog Day event. So very similar to what we saw in August and September when we were in the quiet period. And we just talked about the emergency powers and did not pass legislation. I would anticipate that is the kind of special session it will be.
Minnesota Senate Republicans had previously voted to end those emergency powers, but the DFL-controlled House has upheld them. And North Dakota's Parks and Recreation Department says the parks saw their highest number of campers in history during the 2020 season. There was a 35% increase in campsite nights in 2020 as compared with 2019.
We saw a lot of different folks coming from all over the state and even some of those visitors from outside the state still trying to find those great recreation opportunities right here in North Dakota.
Parks Director Andrea Travnicek says the largest increase in the numbers came during September and October. She says while out-of-state visitation dropped by about 5%, in-state campers more than made up that difference. She does attribute that increase in part to COVID-19 conditions.
The North Dakota State Parks provided those outside large areas where people could still find an area to social distance and recreate where they were a little bit more spaced out than kind of your normal activities that you would find in town sometimes.
The park with the most campers was Grahams Island State Park.
Devil's Lake provides a great fishing industry. So I think you've got folks that just love to get out there. It's a beautiful park. The vicinity close to the water, close to the community of Devil's Lake. So just a lot of different camping opportunities as well as open water opportunities.
North Dakota has 13 state parks. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Residents in one of Minneapolis's most diverse neighborhoods have been talking about the connection between race and health for decades.
Access to care was a major issue for Black people.
In the 1960s, a health center opened that changed things in the community.
People feel safe here.
Could that clinic's focus on gaining trust be a model for the rest of the country? On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today we have an excerpt from this Friday's Prairie Pulse television show that features a discussion about a book that tells the story of innovators and inventors who made a difference where we live. Matt Olien visits with Bruce Jovig, who with co-author Hiram Drockey wrote Innovative Entrepreneurs of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, 150 Years of Impact.
Bruce, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Good to see you again. I ran into you in the old UND days when I was a student up there, and you've been there a long time and doing great work. So thank you for coming on the show.
Glad to be here.
Tell us first about your background, Bruce. Where you're from originally.
Originally, I'm from Crosby, in the very northwest corner, north of Williston, right on that corner. The farm was 3 miles from Canada, 22 miles from Montana.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the University of North Dakota, and I actually was a science major, majoring in zoology, mathematics, and chemistry, triple major.
And so, you kind of made your career at UND, right?
I did. Other than a few years outside, yes. But I started then, went back for fundraising, working with Earl Strinden, and then in 1984 started the Center for Innovation and launched it, which was one of the first four entrepreneur outreach centers in the country.
Yeah. I'll ask you about that later because you're now CEO Emeritus of the center, right? So you and Hiram Drockey, a well-known person in this area, co-wrote this book. Tell us about Hiram's contributions to the book and how you guys happened onto this project.
Hiram has been a longtime friend of mine. As we got together, as I used him quite often as an expert on some of the entrepreneur questions dealing with agriculture, because he is an ag entrepreneur expert, an agricultural innovation expert. And we started talking 4 or 5 years ago about doing a book together with ag entrepreneurs and other entrepreneurs of the state. And I have been collecting entrepreneur stories for 30, 40 years as we did the North Dakota Entrepreneur Hall of Fame and the North Dakota Business Innovator of the Year Awards, annual awards. And we thought that story should be captured. So after talking about it for a couple of years, we finally sat down and decided to do it. And that was shortly after I retired in 2017.
Mm-hmm. Lots of research, right?
Lots of research.
To pin down who to focus on in this book. I'm sure Hiram was a big help with his background in that.
And of course, he did some of the research and something like Norm Jones, Ron Offutt. He knew that story as well as anybody, so he could bring that together. So there was quite a few where he had done the research, and then there was another 40 or so where I had already done some of the research. Then we had to complete the research.
Yeah. Tell me about that. So, again, you knew some of these people, but if you're going to write a book, you really got to nail it down.
You got to nail it down. And over 150 years, obviously, not everybody was alive. So we had a lot of folks from the 100 years ago, 75 years ago, that we had to really, go to the newspapers, go to books, wherever we could to get information. In others, we were able to go to the family and get information. And towards the end of the book, as it comes around, of course, then I got to do primary research, and we got to talk to the folks and interview them and so forth. So it's a process, and it's different whether it was more recent or some time ago.
Yeah. How do you co-write a book with someone? I mean, did Hiram do one chapter, you do another person?
We split it up.
Okay.
Those of which he knew he did. I agreed to do all the research.
Okay.
Where he hadn't already done it. So that was a part of it. Then what he did is he wrote, and it's actually to write small chapters. There's 5 or 6 pages per each one of these. Mm-hmm. There's 64 chapters, 64 different entrepreneur families being profiled. So none of us co-authored a chapter.
Right.
It's one chapter or the other. And he did about a third, and I did about two-thirds of the chapters in the book. And then, of course, it's the editing process. But I did anywhere he hadn't done the research, I agreed to do all the research. He did some of the writing. I did some of the writing.
Okay. So lots of people profiled. Some of the names we all know, Gary Theraldson and people like this. But tell me about how you picked, who you picked, and maybe some of your favorites. Who are some of your favorites?
Well, that's a good question. Because for a while, we had as many as 200 names to choose from that we threw out as possibilities. And then we decided we didn't want the book to be more than 300 pages, so we had to get it down to what it was, the 64. And actually, when I say that, our goal was 50 to 60, and we still went over, right? But it is, and because we really said, and the innovative factor was a part of it that really weeded some up, because we wanted them to both be innovative and an entrepreneur. They had to have both factors. They did something that was unique, different, that really set them aside from somebody else, so it couldn't be a business that replicated something else. There was something unique here, and then they were a good entrepreneur as well.
And who are some of your favorites?
Well, certainly Jay Shuler, just because I know him so well, for doing Giant Seeds. And his whole story of getting also that he is the son of an entrepreneur, and he's the father of two entrepreneurs. And watching that sort of develop as he went through 16 different companies. Mm. I mean, that's a real serial entrepreneur. And, we mostly know him from Seeds 2000. And from Giant Seeds, but he has got a lot of other companies besides that. And, two of them were failures. 14 of them made money. And so that was really sort of an exciting. So certainly Jay, just because how many people do you know start up 16 companies in a career of 30-some years?
Yeah. How about some others that you liked writing about and researching?
Well, certainly Gary Tharaldson's story was terrific, right? I mean, because that is... It's a school teacher becoming an entrepreneur and really dominating and really becoming North Dakota's probably most successful financially of all the entrepreneurs. Certainly Doug Burgum would be in that category. What he did with Great Plains Software and sending it to Microsoft, that's a great high-tech story. And you certainly, even the Dalrymple story of two generations there, the Dalrymple Farms, which is the largest of 91 bonanza farms in the state and really one of the most successful. And, of course, then Jack, also being so successful with the pasta company in Carrington, but then also his political career and what that all meant. And he had his hand in lots of other startups as well.
Yeah. Now, we've had Gary on this show, and you mentioned Jay with some failed businesses. This seems to be a theme. Not everybody hits it out of the park on the first try. Failure
Absolutely.
Is a great motivator, isn't it, Bruce?
It really is. And, and it's not failure if you learn from it. And, and they all picked some mess, they learned some lessons from that challenge, and they learned the importance of persistence and picking yourself back up again and to have another opportunity. And some of them, if you look at also the failures, by the way, if you start a company in the wrong cycle in a market, no matter how good of an idea it is, it still can fail.
Yeah.
Because of cash flow and market forces and all sorts of things that really impact the business. And some of them are that factor as well. Other times, people find opportunity in those market cycles.
Right. That led me to a question I did not have ahead of time, and that is COVID. So you mentioned the right time for businesses. I've had two people now tell me this is actually might be a decent time to start a business, depending on the business. What do you think during COVID? Where are some opportunities, do you think?
Wherever there's a major disruption, there is people get hurt, and that creates, and that disruption creates opportunities for others. So it is, in any time there's disruption in the market, it creates opportunity. So recessions, depressions, things like COVID, rapid change, all of them, for somebody, it's an opportunity. Because the market has changed, and the marketplace has changed. And so like with COVID, certainly you think of the biotech center, it's a huge opportunity for the biotech industry. Huge.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk, you know, Aldevron certainly and Fargo here, they're a big player in that change. But it also, for example, is not a good time to be in the travel business or entertainment or, you
hotels.
Know, or the airline or hotel industry. But the other side of that is for, personal safety equipment, it's a great time for that kind of market. And obviously, if you're into web marketing, because so much right now is moving to the web for marketing and sales of products and technology, even services. So that disruption is creating an opportunity for someone.
And we might know in a couple of years who really took advantage of this.
Who took advantage of it, yeah.
Right. Can you read a passage from the book, Bruce?
Sure. One of my great stories is Cream of Wheat, because everybody can relate to that. In the 1880s and 1890s, there was three companies that went public out of Grand Forks: Nash Finch, C.H. Robinson, and Cream of Wheat. And Cream of Wheat is one of those stories that we just talked about that really came out of the Depression of 1893. They started a flour mill in 1890. In 1893, the world turned upside down as a major crash. And they were making flour, and they were sending it to the East Coast, to New York in particular. And all of a sudden, their markets were disappearing. They had put $100,000 into the company in 1890. They tried to sell it for $5,000 in 1893 in that crash. They couldn't sell the whole company for $5,000. So the bankers who had banking money had to actually put money into the stock. And then they sent, some boxcars. Their miller was taking out of the wheat, taking the middlings, which is the germ part of the wheat, and making a white porridge out of it, hot breakfast porridge. They thought they had nothing to lose, so they sent some cases of Cream of Wheat to their broker in New York who was selling their flour. And this is how quickly a business can pivot. And now they had just sent a boxcar of flour, and in it they had these new boxes of Cream of Wheat, which they come up with that name because it's the creamiest part, the best part of the wheat, and sent them forward. Within 12 hours after the car arrived at Lamont and Corliss, they telegrammed back requesting 50 more cases of Cream of Wheat. The next day, another telegram was even more encouraging. "Never mind shipping us your flour. Send us a carload of Cream of Wheat." As of October 6, 1893, they were no longer in the flour milling. They were in the hot cereal business.
Just like that.
Yes, just like that.
Wow, that's amazing. Let's talk about some other success stories people are familiar with. American Crystal Sugar. How did that get started?
Well, it's very interesting because that was a long germination period, a long pregnancy, so to speak, because Earl Babcock was an engineering professor at UND, and he was one of those guys who was out there. He started the coal mining industry in North Dakota and also in the mining of clay. But then he got talking about crops and how to diversify, because wheat was starting to deplete the soil in North Dakota. Too much of it was being grown on too many rotation years. So he started and this was too far north to grow corn, which was very popular in southern Minnesota and Iowa as a diversification rotation crop. So he started doing field trials on sugar beets, and he got that clue from the Germans. We're doing that. So he started working with the farmers and doing field trials and found out this was superior soil and weather for growing beets. They were getting great tonnage per acre and a great percentage of sugar content. And so he really pushed that from the 1890s, and then the Chamber of Commerce of Grand Forks really got behind him and with the farmers, and they basically went to American Crystal Sugar out of Denver, which was owned by the Oxnard family, and convinced them to build, in Grand Forks. They didn't want to build, so they actually went and bought a abandoned sugar beet found out of California and moved it to East Grand Forks. And that started the sugar beet industry in Grand Forks, and that took till 1926. So we started doing those field trials in 1890. The Chamber of Commerce got on in some place, I don't remember the exact year, it's in the book, but let's say in the mid, roughly 1915. And it took till 1926 until actually the plant was bought. Now, they were growing sugar beets at this time, but sending them south into southern Minnesota to be processed, which means there wasn't a lot of profit at that point. They needed to bring the processing up here to be profitable. And then there wasn't another sugar beet plant built after 1926 until after World War II. And then four more were built, which became now, you know, over a $1 billion industry in the Red River Valley.
Yeah, Hillsboro, all the plants.
Hillsboro, Drayton, exactly. Yeah.
How about Melrose? That's a huge one.
Huge one. Three-generation family of the Melrose and Dolls. And of course, E.G. Melrose started, he was just one of those inventive farmers that was just terrific down by Gwinner. Really, you know, first of all, he did one of the first early tractors, and then he started doing, you know, swathing equipment, harvesting equipment. And really, that's, you know, he just really did a super job. And the, I can't think of the name all of a sudden, the rake. But, you know, it was... But it just a great manufacturing friend that brought his sons in, brought Gene Dahl, his son-in-law, into the company. And, of course, they just found new opportunities as they met then also with the, you know, and doing the Melrose Bobcat, you know, and bringing that in, which really was to clean turkey barns, but now it's mostly known for construction.
Right.
And then, of course, and then selling it so it could grow. And then the family, Gene Dahl and his family, you know, they put the money back in, and then they become, you know, went to the Steiger family up in Red Lake Falls and did Steiger Tractor. So, I mean, it's you think they were the first major prairie industrialists. The biggest manufacturers out here in the prairies was started because of E.G. Melrose and their family. So it's a very important story. And just think about just the Steiger Tractor. Gene Dahl was a wonderful friend and advocate for the Center for Innovation. But one time we sat down, and he said that he had traced 35 companies that had started because of the Steiger foil tractor. So not only was he an entrepreneur, he allowed 35 other folks to be entrepreneurs, making equipment for the Steiger tractor and be a supplier, a vendor, follow-on equipment, whatever the case may be. But there was 35 companies that were created because of the Steiger tractor.
Right. Now, let's talk about some newer entrepreneurs, Kerry Warburg Block, who we've profiled here at Prairie Public, and Michael Chambers. Tell us about those two.
Well, you know, Kerry was very interesting. Her father was an entrepreneur. He was, you know, a gas station entrepreneur out in Williston, North Dakota. And he was also, by education, he was worked with insects and pest control and so forth. And so as a little girl traveling, and her father was her inspiration, she started making stuff. And this whole idea of, you know, of getting rid of mice by natural ways, not using traps, she started when she had married a farmer from Newtown and found out the mice problem on the farm. And so and she was determined to find a way to repel mice, and thinking about, now mice don't like smell. Now they smell. They're very sensitive to smell. And these smells, and she had used, when the mouse ran up her leg one time, she grabbed the perfumer thing and sprayed it, and they ran away, and a couple others also ran out of the cab when she was starting, and that gave her the idea of this natural repellent. And so she is a major entrepreneur in developing a whole new category.
Yeah.
And that's what's really sort of fascinating, right? Because before then, you think pest control, like mouse control, was all based on either traps or killing or
chemicals,
or poisoning, right? And here she had a whole nother way and created a whole new category and really developing it over time. And then, of course, finding out the challenges of the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
That was a major challenge. And they told her she could spend, you know, 5 years and $2 million, which she had neither 5 years or $2 million. And she found to cut that way down and got some grants to do it, got it the FDA approval for, a chemical-free way to repel mice instead of kill mice.
Yep.
So, I mean, just a great innovation.
And Michael Chambers.
I met Michael actually as a student. He came up to the Center for Innovation up there when he was an NDSU student. And I worked with him to help start the company with John Ballantyne. And as they went through the whole process. But this is now the foremost leader of the biotech and bioscience industry in North Dakota. It started when he was in college. And that company was formed. He basically had trouble raising money, so they used credit cards. And so, And I would not recommend for our viewing listeners that this is a great, but it worked for him, right? But it is, and so he used his credit cards as, and until he got going and got his first orders, and it has been just a wild success. And with, since we're talking about COVID, I think it's very important to know that there's 40 companies right now that are looking at a vaccine or therapies for COVID. Every one of them has ties. Every one of them has a tie to Aldevron. Hmm. Now think about that.
Yeah.
So Fargo, the company from Fargo is at the center of how we are going to solve the COVID problem. Now that's simply amazing. You know, and there's like nine companies now that are sort of in a race to get a vaccine, and all of those 40, and you know, and Aldevron is providing the platform for the science that they're using to get a vaccine.
Yeah.
That's so, I mean, that's, and I couldn't give you a current headcount, but I think they're like 400 employees right now, maybe on their way to 500. And they're on their way with their expansion when they open up their new buildings. They're on their way to 1,000 employees. Wow. And now that is just a wonderful thing.
Tell us about the UND Center for Innovation.
I started it in 1984 with the idea in mind that I hadn't started really noticed that the major employers in North Dakota really are not branch offices from elsewhere, but people who really started companies here, whether that be on Main Street or manufacturing companies, everything else. And I really saw a real need for people to learn the skills of starting and growing a company. And what I did was the fourth entrepreneur outreach center in the nation. And I wanted it around innovation. So the first name was the Center for Innovation and Business Development. And business development was the word we used that time at entrepreneurship, which wasn't quite in vogue yet. But by 5-6 years later, it was. So I wish I would have had that trend before. I should have had the Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. But the Center for focused on that, and then we added angel capital as a major focus as a part of that, which is the mother's milk of growth for innovative companies. And so it was a terrific one. And by the time I retired in 2017, we had received 18 national and international awards for excellence. And we were featured as one of the six most important venture development organizations in the United States helping start and grow companies. So that was terrific. So, I mean, it was a great run. I loved it. And, you know, what I really loved was the people. Yep. I love entrepreneurs. Yep.
Lastly, if people want your book, you and Hiram's book, where can they find it?
They can find it online at dakotabooknet.com. So okay. It's booknet.com, dakotabooknet.com. Or you can find it in some of the regional bookstores.
Okay.
I am now working to see what we can do to get it also into the state historical bookstores because it's history of North Dakota.
Okay. Thanks, Bruce, for being here.
Glad to be here.
That was Prairie Public's Matt O'Lean in a discussion with Bruce Jovig about the book he co-authored with Hiram Drockey, Innovative Entrepreneurs of North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, 150 Years of Impact. Hiram Drockey passed away on October 17th. Shortly after the recording of the conversation. You can see the Prairie Pulse television show this Friday on our television service. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. Serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, hydro, and nuclear. Basin Electric Power Cooperative, striving to be your trusted energy partner.
And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant at the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 10th, celebrating 100 years since the passage of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. This series is written and voiced by Sarah Walker.
Suffragists Alice Paul and Lucy Burns learned about militant protest tactics from suffrage efforts in England. They felt such tactics could help in the United States, but the National American Women's Suffrage Association did not approve, so they founded a separate group, the National Woman's Party, under Alice Paul's leadership. In January of 1917, they organized the first ever picket of the White House, which lasted 18 months. Beulah Amidon, daughter of Judge Amidon of Fargo, was one of the early participants. At first, this silent picketing was smiled at by local police and President Wilson, but soon their presence began to create some agitation, especially as the United States entered World War I. On the picket line, Lucy Burns displayed one banner that read, "Kaiser Wilson, have you forgotten your sympathy with the poor Germans because they are not self-governed? 20 million women are not self-governed. Take the beam out of your own eye." As wartime patriotism escalated, the banners provoked hostile responses from onlookers, leading to shouting and even riots. Many denounced the actions of the militant suffragists, including Dr. Anna Howard Shaw of the National American Woman Suffrage Association. In North Dakota, the Steel Ozone newspaper in Kidder County equated suffragists with national threats, arguing that the government should do more to harden their policies in dealing with, quote, spies, German agents, and suffrage pickets. In October, a group of picketing suffragists, including Alice Paul, were arrested and given a 7-month sentence at a workhouse. Paul soon began to refuse to eat. By this date, she was several days into a hunger strike. But North Dakotans proudly noted that Dr. Cora Smith King, her physician, was a North Dakota native and a graduate of UND. King was also on the Advisory Council of the Congressional Union for Women's Suffrage and treasurer of the National Council of Women Voters. In the meantime, other members of the National Women's Party used the fall months to tour various parts of the country. Mabel Vernon, National Secretary of the party, spoke in Grand Forks and Fargo. She stated, "I recently had an interview with President Wilson in which he gave every indication that he will put his power behind the suffrage amendment. It is difficult to say how he could do otherwise. The nation must soon establish at home the democracy for which we are fighting abroad. This cannot be done until all our women citizens are enfranchised." This is Sarah Walker.
This series is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota and the North Dakota Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And if you want to find any Main Street show, you can find it at prairiepublic.org. Wednesday on our show, it's Veterans Day. We'll share episodes from Telltale, Dakota Folklife, and stories that feature firsthand accounts of the experiences of veterans. Telltale is a project of the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we'll talk about Veterans Day with state folklorist Troy Geist and his collaborator, Makoche Studios producer David Swenson. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.